You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Toby toku ingoa.
Ko Theo toku ingoa.
No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. We're your co-hosts, Toby and Theo, and we'll be with you for the next hour.
Yeah, whai ake nei, coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the recently signed city deal between Auckland Council and the central government. I also spoke to Associate Professor Alexandra Andov on the implications of government adoption of AI. Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Auckland University's Chris Ogden about the election results in Hungary and the future of right-wing authoritarianism. He aha o whakaaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so do get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395.
Kaua e wareware, e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. He pākehere, roki roki mārunga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Last Friday, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon and Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown announced the signing of a new city deal. The deal will see closer partnership between the central government and Auckland Council, coordinating planning in areas such as infrastructure and transportation. The deal will see a long-term partnership between the government and council with regular meetings and cooperation on strategies for innovation and transportation, with reviews of sporting venues such as Eden Park and the Auckland Tennis Centre. However, the deal has been critiqued by some as being a collection of promises without any new funding. So, for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, we discussed the signing of the Auckland City Deal and how the Green Party would work with Auckland Council on issues such as transportation and infrastructure. Kia ora, Ricardo. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Kia ora. Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, last week we saw the National Government, or the National Coalition Government, announce a deal with the Auckland Council, a kind of memorandum of understanding, I guess. How important is collaboration between our cities and the government for the Green Party?
We've long called for more resources to be given to local government by central government in greater partnership for things like infrastructure projects, the coordination of public transport systems, and to have the housing stock, including state housing stock, that we desperately need. So while the deal is welcomed, we obviously have some criticisms of it due to the lack of clarity for some of our more affected communities by the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, so I think zooming in on that, recently we saw Manukau Ward Councillor Lotu Fuli say that not much really changes with the deal in terms of money. There's a lot of talk about growth, but not really any clear funding or timelines or targets for jobs or anything just yet. Would the Green Party take a different stance in regard to this issue?
Yeah, the problem that we have is that the so-called growth that the central government is lauding, it relies on fast-track projects which have very little community input. It relies on projects that are already well were underway. And I think what we need is a clear plan for the government on, for example, how we're going to revitalize South Auckland that has been particularly affected by youth unemployment right now through no fault of their own, and to see those communities in South Auckland have a vision from central local government around better public transport, better quality housing stock, as well as there's some issues that I think haven't been adequately addressed, which is more about, for example, the future of rail in Auckland beyond the city rail link. And these are things that we think should be prioritized in any future deal, as well as greater input and power sharing between central local government and Mana Whenua as well, which is something that, in my view, is lacking in this deal.
So would that include something like the often talked about proposed light rail of a few past governments.
We've long called for light rail across Dominion Road and to the airport, ideally. And for the Greens, we've been really clear that where the previous government failed was in not delivering surface light rail, which would have been less disruptive for businesses, would have been built faster, and at a small fraction of the cost that the previous government was hoping to build its underground project. But we do think collaboration between central and local government is key to deliver those projects as well. And Mana Whenua input is critical.
So jumping on to that kind of transport aspect of the deal, it includes a 30-year transport policy looking at kind of projects across the city, such as the Northwest Rapid Transit Project, removing level crossings from train lines. Jumping to Auckland more broadly, what improvements would the Green Party like to see in transport across kind of all of the Auckland region?
Yeah, so obviously these are things that are well underway, and there are some things that have merit and that need to be done around, you know, the level of crossings for the city rail link. And, you know, we do deserve better public transport towards the airport. But I think the key thing that we're lacking is a proper comprehensive rail network across our city. And this is why a commitment to building light rail across Dominion Road, as well as having it to the airport, would be ideal to genuinely connect our city. And I do support, though, the sentiments from the government that Auckland needs to be seen as much more than just the city. It is our largest city, and it's quite big geographically. So this is why having a vision for the next few decades of a genuine rail network would be ideal, to also better support communities in places like South Auckland, and to genuinely connect all of our communities together.
So looking at those kind of that kind of connection across the city, the deal has also promised that there will be more time spent looking into another Waitemata crossing. Is this a priority for the Green Party?
It's not a priority, but we've always been clear that any second Waitemata crossing needs to be rail-enabled at the very least. And my concern would be that we would have a second crossing that does not have rail, and the danger with that is that it's the Americanization of our transport system, where central and local government believe that just one more lane will fix our traffic woes, when we know that what we need is investment in things like rail and a more frequent and affordable bus network as well.
So in the meantime, there's also been talk of time of use charging. Now, I know that recently there was a bit of controversy over some of the proposed prices for that, but would something like time of use charging on sections like the Harbour Bridge to discourage that kind of traffic and to help fund its, you know, repair and maintenance, would that be something that the Green Party would support, or would you be pressing more for other alternatives?
I think we would like to see other alternatives put in place and a recalibration of the government's transport plans. We've, for example, showed across the country that the government would be better able to prioritize resources towards maintenance and building, for example, rail in many of our cities at a much smaller fraction of the cost that a lot of the roading projects that this government wants to do, which have really poor business cases. And so I think that people should not be paying the price of the government forcing New Zealanders to effectively pay for decades to come for roading projects that will be massively expensive. And then on top of that, increase the cost of living for people, when we could be doing the exact opposite, spending less money on public transport systems and then using the rest for maintenance.
Yeah, and I think Mayor Wayne Brown is on your side when it comes to not being a big fan of the big roading projects. Something he is
hitting the mark on a few things lately. Yeah.
something he is a big fan of, though, is the proposed bed tax or bed levy or accommodation levy, depending on what you want to call it, which would go towards funding for major events. Is that something that you guys would be supportive of, or not really on the radar?
A bed tax is something that we're open to, and it's a lot less regressive in that regard. And we do welcome a lot of the latest comments by the mayor around some of the funding mechanisms that we could utilize as well. But more importantly, again, like, what our vision for Auckland deserves is one where we actually prioritize solutions that are based on evidence, right? And this is why transport will be critical to that. the quicker we invest, again, and I go back to rail, the more productive our economy will be. But also, for example, we'll have less trucks on our roads because we'll be having greater transport of our goods through rail as opposed to trucks. And that will, in and of itself, also lower the bill for Aucklanders for road maintenance as a result of the damage that so much of our goods that are being transported by truck causes on our roads as well.
So now just jumping back to a point you made earlier about how we can't really treat Auckland as just another city, given it's such a huge area in terms of both land and population. We've seen a lot of disagreements between the council and the government, especially over recent months, between housing and public transport policy. With Auckland's population making up about a third of the country, should the council have more power to govern without interference from central government? Maybe drawing the line at not quite becoming a sovereign city state, but somewhere in that kind of pendulum.
No, we would support that, and that is the genuine feeling of and ambition of genuinely supporting local communities to make local decisions. And a really good example of where localism is failing in Auckland is that the central government wants to force West and South Auckland to carry the burden of intensification while protecting leafy, expensive suburbs like Remuera and Epsom from carrying the load as well. And this is why council has been better placed to make these decisions, because you're taking into account not just who your donors and constituents are, but you're taking more a city approach to solutions. And it's easier to take an evidence-led approach when we have localized proposals and policies as well.
All right. And now just to kind of round things off, broadly speaking, what would a Green Party strategy for Auckland kind of look like in terms of maybe funding for museums or just broadly?
Our vision for Auckland would be on supercharging our public transport system. It would also be about working collaboratively to restore the public housing bills that were paused by this government, and to not put the burden on South and West Auckland on intensification and push ahead with changes that would see more dense housing in areas like Remuera and Epsom, so that we all share the load. Also, it would more deeply involve Mana Whenua and give more decision-making powers around the future, not just consult with them. And also, we would have included more on job creation in South Auckland, as well as a plan to collaborate to end homelessness in our city, which is an issue that I think has been overlooked in this collaboration and the plan, and the government just keeps punching down on our homeless, which is becoming a more and more visible thing in our city.
Ricardo, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the recent signing of the Auckland City deal.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
You know he take me very far. Jaja, I'm the guiding star. He bring the light when everything dark. He's the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. You can't fool Jaja, got a himself the trend. Well, no for them my false and no for them pretend. Soon them I go get the fire burn, burn them. No, you can't hide or run away in a judgment. You're not get no. Guiding star.
know it take me very far. Judge, I'm the guiding star. You bring me light when everything dark.
Famous True School Hip Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts, and the one show to know.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip hop.
True School Hip Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Auraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
We've done it! We've got our hands on a receptacle more tempting than Pandora's box, more glorious than the Ark of the Covenant, and with more drops than Davy Jones' locker. It's Southbound Record Crate.
Tune into From the Crate every Friday on 95 BFM Breakfast to discover a plethora of oral treasure. Cam from Southbound has dug up the latest new releases, reissues and re-releases. Thanks to Southbound Records. In store at 132 Simon Street and online at southbound.co.nz.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Over the weekend, Hungary held its 2026 general election, which saw the largest voter turnout in Hungary's history as a democratic state. The electrified populace delivered a landslide victory for the relatively new Respect and Freedom Party, securing them a two-thirds majority in parliament. Incumbent Prime Minister Viktor Orban has lost power after 16 years. For some younger voters, he is the only prime minister they can remember. Orban has been a controversial figure throughout his long political career. To some, he is a power-hungry authoritarian who stood in the way of European unity. To his supporters, which include US President Donald Trump, he is precisely the kind of powerful leader that a country like Hungary needs. This morning, I spoke to Chris Ogden, Professor of Global Studies at Auckland University, about what Orban's defeat means for the future of global authoritarianism. 1 week ago, US Vice President J.D. Vance visited Hungary, where he held a press conference and endorsed Orbán's re-election campaign. Trump has also publicly expressed his support for Orbán many times. Do you agree with the commentators who say that the endorsements by Trump and Vance actually worked against Orbán?
It's possible to a degree. Certainly would seem that international sentiment towards the United States and Trump itself is waning. But at the same time, I think there are distinct domestic angles. Orbán had been in power for a very long time, clearly authoritarian in nature, clearly attacking civil society in lots of different ways. But certainly, whatever happened, he still lost by a landslide.
So you said that Orbán's electoral defeat may pose a threat to what you call the global MAGA movement. I'm going to give you a list of foreign leaders who have endorsed Orbán, and then I'm going to ask you to comment. So we've got, obviously, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Benjamin Netanyahu, Giorgia Meloni of Italy, Javier Milei of Argentina, José Antonio Kast of Chile, among many others. So do you view all of these leaders as part of what you call a global MAGA movement? And if so, what beliefs or interests do they all have in common? Other than being on the political right, what is particularly similar about the way they see the world and the visions they have for their respective nations?
So I think the biggest commonality is they're all very conservative. They're all pro-American. They're all authoritarian in nature and action. So that means using the rule of law for their own ends. That means attacking civil society. That means attacking electoral rights. And all of that is leaning away from what you could consider to be the kind of liberal world order based upon shared values, rule of international law, these kind of factors. So I think that's what would bind them together. I think it's difficult to say that they're a very kind of distinct, unified group, but I think more kind of they're on that end of the international spectrum.
Is Vladimir Putin pro-America?
I don't know if it's instinctively about being pro-American. I think it's more about their attitude towards the international system. So you can certainly see the US president, for example, attacking international law, trying to sidestep certain multilateral institutions. You could say the same is true for Vladimir Putin. You could say the same is true for some of the other leaders that you mentioned. So I don't think it's necessarily about kind of seeing them as a unified bloc or being pro-America or pro-this or pro-Trump. I think it's more the kind of worldview that they're projecting and also a rejection of many of the core pillars of the current international order.
These are all leaders who some of the harshest critics would say have fascist tendencies. Do you think that's too strong a word to use about these kinds of leaders, including Orbán?
I think certainly highly autocratic. They all want centralized power. They all, to some degree, I mean, maybe not Meloni, but they all, to some degree, have a kind of cult of personality around them. And that certainly can be regarded as fascist. There is also certainly evidence in all of those countries of a kind of partnering or a co-option of oligarchs. That's also a sign of fascism. So in many ways, I think that that could be a fair explanation.
So from the point of view of European security, one of the most significant results of this election is the money that will become available for Ukraine.
I would say that the biggest impact for the European Union is that Orbán has been seen to be pro-Putin, or at least anti-EU. So this will act internally to remove that roadblock. So we might be able to see a much more cohesive European foreign policy that could extend to Ukraine, it could extend to other issues.
You say that despite Orbán's loss, his 16 years in power has been a boost for global authoritarianism. In your view, what are the main long-lasting effects of Orbán's time in office, and what would it take to undo the damage?
So certainly, the longer someone's in political office, the greater change they can have upon society. So if you think for the average kind of 20-year-old, the kind of average student at the University of Auckland, they'll have had their whole life under Viktor Orbán. This does something psychologically to a population in terms of how they think, what they expect, how they're educated, how they regard the government, how they regard the law, rule of law. And we shouldn't forget that Viktor Orbán was in power for a long time because people supported him. So that suggests something deep down within that society, that there's a kind of dedicated group that thinks autocracy to some degree is a good idea. In terms of overcoming it,
certainly the incoming leader's got a super majority. Certainly they've got lots of power to overturn things that Orban's done. This could relate to kind of freeing up freedoms of the press, for example, more freedoms of expression within universities. And certainly I think that those things will happen. But again, it's in a kind of enculturation effect. So it will take quite a long time for the adjustment to come back. And I think it's too simple to say, well, Orban's gone, Hungary just naturally goes back to democracy. And then as to your wider point, Orban in many ways was at the vanguard of the kind of new wave of autocracy, or some people kind of call it a third wave of autocracy, showing you how to do it if you have such kind of tendencies. So that's why he's been a kind of poster child for MAGA, but also kind of conservative or autocratic regimes across the world. And certainly just because he's gone doesn't mean that the lessons of what he's done have also gone. So I think for any kind of wannabe autocrats out there, there'll always be a kind of Orban playbook to copy.
We should also talk about the incoming Prime Minister. While Orban's defeat is significant, his replacement does not represent a radical shift to the left by any means. Up until 2 years ago, Peter Magyar was himself a member of Orban's party, where he was described as a powerful insider. The party which he now leads is considered ideologically conservative and centre-right. So with that in mind, are we likely to see much change at all?
Yeah, this is a really great observation. So I think one of the biggest things that we've got to think about in global politics is that the centre ground itself has shifted to the right. So that's why we end up talking about far right becoming normalised, because that centre ground is kind of closer to the far right now. And that's often why left parties are now castigated as being far left. So certainly that suggests ideologically he's got roots within Orban's party. That means he was there for 14 years or all the time that Orban was doing all of these things. So there's a definite risk that he is kind of Orban light, as it were. And really only time will tell in terms of what he really does. But certainly the overall trend is that politics itself, like that kind of rightwards kind of turn, is becoming much more normalised. So in a way, we shouldn't really expect fundamental change.
That was Professor Chris Ogden, Programme Director for Global Studies at the University of Auckland.
School now. Call me the snack man, prince of the sprinkles. Coated my sandwich with jelly crystals. Cloudy old taste buds register nothing my dad created. He will be the most popular boy at school. I distribute the flavors I find, so divine. I can't wait to get to school now, so I can blow my friends out.
I said I sent you a link, see what you think. There's a whole lot of shit they don't want you to know. And then I get the feeling this world is on reeling. It's going down the rabbit hole. He said, I sent you a link, see what you think. There's a whole lot of shit they don't want you to know. And then I get the feeling his world is on real. And he's going down the rabbit hole.
Here I go, going down the rabbit hole. Chicago, going down the
The use of AI across industries and governments is increasing at a rapid rate. However, recent gaffes involving improper AI usage in government agencies have continued to raise concerns about these tools' shortcomings and how well regulated they are. In Aotearoa New Zealand, the government has provided advice on how agencies should go about using AI, but has stopped short of regulating this technology itself. This week, experts will be gathering at the University of Auckland for the Law, Technology and Government Conference, which will discuss government use and regulation of AI, amongst other issues. This morning, I was joined by Professor Alexandra Andov, an organiser and speaker at the conference, to discuss Aotearoa New Zealand's approach to AI and government. Kia ora, Professor Alexandra Andov. So first of all, I just wanted to start out quite broadly with how has the government been approaching adoption of AI?
Kia ora, Gio. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the question. And great question. So there are a couple of things. On one hand, we know last year the government published kind of a clear policy that it is not aiming to regulate AI. So that's on one hand side. So whatever the businesses and industries do, it's up to them. And the government at this stage is not planning to regulate AI in any shape or form. However, also last year, I believe it was February or March 2025, the government published the guidance on responsible use of AI for the public service, okay? And here the government kind of approaches it fairly broadly in a sense that, you know, the use of AI by the government should be done following certain principles like transparency and making sure that there is no bias, limited discrimination, and so on. But yes, so we have this kind of two approaches. One on, like, there's no regulation, and the other is specific kind of guidance when the AI is used by the government in public services.
Right, so we're not looking to regulate AI broadly, but just kind of that in-house kind of rules on how to use it.
Correct.
Cool.
And this is done ultimately by following well-known OECD AI principles. So these principles, so to speak, New Zealand adopted, and it's saying that ultimately, in the light of these principles, also the government will deploy and utilize AI in public services.
Right. So what we're doing is in line with what's happening internationally.
Yes and no, because there are a number of governments and countries across the world that actually recognize that we need to regulate AI. So it's not just that we create principles for the public organizations and bodies to when they use AI, but also that generally we should actually adopt specific laws and regulations when it comes to AI.
Is that something that anyone in New Zealand is looking at pursuing currently?
When you ask anyone, do you mean like specific political parties or...?
I suppose if there's any politicians who are looking at this or any particular groups that are advocating for this approach to AI.
So I would say that I'm not aware of any political parties to wanting to adopt AI regulation because it's fairly complex, and I think then that majority of politicians try to be a little bit more conservative and observe what is happening and then kind of act a little bit maybe later. The industry itself, like the tech industry at this stage, is not necessarily looking into self-regulate, but there are undoubtedly different groups that are looking into this, including MedSafe and different kinds of unions and organizations kind of trying to understand what we should do and how we should protect our data, our workers, and so on.
Right. So jumping into that regulation of kind of in-house use of it,
yeah.
We've seen a few issues crop up recently in the news of some kind of problematic AI usage. So thinking about how it came to light that corrections staff were breaching their AI policy in using it to draft formal reports. We've also seen in recent times the health system introduced an AI chatbot called Heidi, who was jailbroken quite easily and made to say some things that it maybe shouldn't have, like how to cook meth. Now, there wasn't any actual kind of patient data or infrastructure that was compromised by this, but do these kind of issues show maybe a slightly too speedy adoption of AI by these kind of government agencies, or is this just like a usual ironing out kinks as they appear kind of thing?
That's a hard question, right? I think that on a certain level, government needs to be cautious what exactly they are doing, and maybe even more cautious than any kind of companies or corporations. So, but I do think that, you know, AI in general, no matter whatever the tech companies are saying, it has its limitations, and it has many limitations. It has also numerous cybersecurity issues. It has obviously trustworthiness issues. AI never knows when it is right or wrong. It will try to persuade you, no matter what, that it, whatever it gives you, it's the correct answer. And I think this is something in the features of the AI that, you know, you might want to iron later on, but you never will get out, because this is how it ultimately is designed from the get-go. And I think that we, and not just the government, but everyone who uses AI needs to be aware of this. And when and if the government decides that it will replace humans by AI in some activities, then it needs to bear in mind that whatever that AI is going to say, it should be binding the government, right? So it should be super, super cautious and careful when it decides to do so.
Do you think there's a bit of a kind of looser expectation around what AI can say? Like looking at things like, you know, what the jailbroken Heidi AI said.
Yeah.
Is that kind of held to a different standard to other government communications? Like, obviously, if a healthcare worker said that kind of stuff, we'd be like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But because it's AI, are we treating it a bit more loosely than we should?
I think you are right. We are. But I think it's a matter of time. So there are a number of cases across the world where, and this is not necessarily government. Oh, there are actually some governmental cases also from Europe, but also companies' cases. So, for instance, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, Air Canada had its own kind of AI chatbot, and it promised a certain price for a ticket to a customer. And then later on, obviously, when a human looked at it, said, "Ah, this is too low, and different price should be applied." But then the court came in and said, no, the AI, because you deploy it, because this AI is on your website and it represents you as if any other human would, it has the same binding kind of consequences. So even if we now might, you know, take it a little bit, as you said, loosely, I think that in the long term, if we really want to use AI, then fine, but it has to have certain consequences as well.
Right, and I guess that would then shift the kind of burden of ironing out these flaws to the provider who's providing this AI, since they'll be held to account 100%. To what it says.
Exactly, right? Because now, you know, we pay a huge amount of money for different kinds of AI tools, but yet on the bottom they always say, oh, check the information and we are not bound, and different kinds of disclosure statements are there. And I'm like, well, you know, this is a little bit counterintuitive. If you provide services, you need to be held to a certain standard for the services. Otherwise, why am I paying you, right?
Right, so shifting to what we'll see this evening with the Law, Technology and Government conference kicking off, are we expecting to see AI feature quite prominently? I imagine it's going to come up a lot.
Yes. So we actually have more or less one day that we will talk and focus on AI, and that will be actually on Friday. We will talk. We will show different kinds of AI tools specifically within legal industry. So there will be a little bit of a demo and a little bit of a show, but then we will actually invite these providers and sit down and ask hard questions about cybersecurity, protection of the data, things that, you know, as we are talking about now, what happens if the tool actually spews information that are completely incorrect or that simply should not be an outcome of a query. And then we'll also talk about what are the pros and cons when it comes to governing AI versus regulating. So what if we kind of adopt more of a governance, a little bit more looser rules and principles rather than very hardcore regulation? Then we'll talk about also we have a specific panel organized by NetSafe that will talk about AI and internet safety because we have seen that, you know, obviously the ability of AI to scale certain behavior is really, really powerful, and this might be extremely harmful in the context of the internet. And then the last session will be on AI and creativity as a human kind of feature, and what does the AI give and what does it take away.
Professor Alexandra Andoff, thanks very much for joining us this morning, and all the best for the conference this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was the University of Auckland's Professor Alexandra Andhove on the issues relating to AI and government in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Thank you.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki mātou mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpa Wednesday.
Thank you to all of our guests, including the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Professor Chris Ogden from the University of Auckland, and Professor Alexandra Antov from the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.